Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
Now, straight from the headlines, we bring you the latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with East County Magazine and KNSJ, and I'm here today with Stephen Bartholow, the editor of SanteePatch.com. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Stephen has been covering a hot issue out there in Santee involving the efforts to widen Prospect Street. And the city council just voted to begin the process of eminent domain to seize a number of properties out there. Steve, can you bring us up to date a bit on the latest?
Most definitely. Well, this is the Prospect Avenue widening project. They actually haven't begun the process of eminent domain with seizing properties, but they got approval to do so in case they need to. It's more of a leveraging chip, bargaining chip, if you will, with the negotiations that are ongoing with the homeowners. But they're trying to do some improvements out there. It was originally called the Prospect Redevelopment Project. It came about in 2011 when all the state's redevelopment funds were in question whether they were going to take them back. So Santee did a quick move and put in the bid about a day before the time was up to do these last projects. So they got $24 million to do this Prospect Avenue widening. Got the money just in time.
Tell us what the project would include and why this is deemed so important by people in the city that they would be trying to seize portions of 99 different properties, some temporary, some permanently.
Prospect Avenue is the third biggest thoroughfare going east and west in Santee, second to Mission Gorge and Mast Boulevard, and Prospect is south of Mission Gorge. They're trying to redo about a mile stretch, the most traffic stretch, between Cuyamaca and Magnolia. They're adding sidewalks, curbs, gutters, some nice landscaping, according to the design project, undergrounding the utility wires. They're putting new lighting in, new drainage, adding on-street parking, bike lanes. So they're doing the whole boulevard redevelopment down there. Why they're doing this is another question. People on the message boards and people I've talked to have asked that very thing. Why are they working on this project instead of others, like, say, the Mast Boulevard through to Lakeside issue?
Good question. What's your view on that? Do you have some insights?
Well, I think this is a project that the city has simply been looking at for decades at this point. If I remember correctly, they said they had this in the city plans when they incorporated over 30 years ago. I think this is a case of a project they've had on the books for a long time they've trying to do, and the time came to take the money to do it, and so they're gung-ho on it. They're not stepping back. Why exactly? What is along that thoroughfare? People have said it's not a road taken to very many places these days. There are a lot of things along the road, but it doesn't take you very many places, if you will. Mission Gorge is much more functional for that.
Now let's talk about the people who are actually going to be impacted. I understand there are 99 properties on 9 different streets. It isn't just Prospect. About 2/3 of those are just temporary for construction access, but there's a couple of dozen that are going to lose a portion of the property, and then there's 4 that stand to potentially have their entire properties seized. When I say seized, the city would have to pay for the supposedly fair market value, but it's not necessarily something that these property owners want to have happen. Can you tell us about those families and those property owners and what their views are on this whole thing?
Sure. So there's 24 properties that would have partial easements, meaning the city would be taking part of their property, mostly for parking and landscaping issues. But there are 4 properties the city wants to completely take, and at least one of those 4 properties has publicly noted their opposition to their property being taken.
This is the family that's been there for 50 years.
50 years, the Duff family. They've been there for 50 years. Like they said, there were cow pastures there when they moved in, and they do not want to move. They have an issue that their home, they took a second mortgage on it recently and remodeled it. Of course, if the city takes it and demolishes it, there's, you know, why did they remodel it? They'd lose all that money.
Yeah, that sounds like a real social justice issue. Really, it's a kind of a case of ordinary people who move there, have no idea this could happen 50 years down the road, and now all of a sudden what they've built their lives around may not be there anymore.
Yeah, well, the area has changed quite a bit in 50 years, too, where it was primarily residential when they may have purchased it. Right now, it's primarily commercial. They're one of the few residences in the area that are still occupying there. But they have been there for a long time. It's no reason to, just because they've been there so long, it's not a reason to take their property. The city has agreed to get into deeper negotiations with the family. It seems to have taken the family coming to city council and laying out to city council their situation for the city staff to see the light on the situation, I think. But it should turn out well, I think, for the family.
Now, I understand this was a unanimous vote, although at least some of the people have expressed some misgivings. Randy Vopel, the mayor, had some interesting things to say about this.
Well, Randy is a man of personal rights, if you will. He does not like the concept of giving over to the greater good for personal rights. So, yeah, he said that he is not a fan of eminent domain, that he thinks it has elements of communism in it. Nonetheless, he did vote for this case of eminent domain. And it's a situation where the city, to go ahead with the project, the city says they need these properties, and so that's the course they're going down.
Very interesting. You know, this is an all-conservative Republican council, and typically one thing the Republican Party says it stands for is standing up for private property rights and keeping government off people's backs. So why didn't that happen here, do you think?
It's an issue of the city government's needs trumping ideology in this case.
Is it a case of trying to put the public good ahead, or is there some other factor at play here?
I've found no other factors at play, but the council's vote was based on redevelopment that in order for this project to go forward, we need these parcels. The council is overall a conservative ideology, but they don't let that get in the way of doing city business.
Eminent domain is an interesting issue. It's most commonly used, I think, when there's a freeway or they need the right of way. And on the one hand, it can be very difficult. The home's going through that. The family's going through that. On the other hand, we've seen some instances of people who said, why wasn't eminent domain declared on my house? They built some huge project of wind turbines, for example, is a recent example, where people are saying, wait a minute, my property value went down 40%. I had no say-so in this. Why was I not offered some compensation for the loss in my property value? So I guess the concept behind it is trying to offer some sense of fairness that if we're going to ruin somebody's property, the city should at least compensate them. But there's also the issue of free will. And is it right? When should the government be able to make those kind of decisions and when shouldn't it?
That's a serious question. The fact of the matter is right now eminent domain works in the benefit of the government, less towards the benefit of the people as far as if someone wants their property to be taken by eminent domain, which is an interesting situation. But you're right, exactly, that they would have preferred, if the project is going to go forward, take my property. But
or compensate for the reduced value, at
exactly.
least.
So at the moment, that the laws just aren't set up that way, so that at least through eminent domain, and there are probably other, you can sue for just about anything these days, but eminent domain is strictly a feature that the government gets to play with right now.
This is really a classic case of the rights of private property, the rights of individuals versus the greater good.
This is definitely a classic case of that. But hopefully in this case, everybody's going to be happy in the end. The city's said they're still continuing negotiations. The eminent domain issue, like I said, they're just keeping that as leverage. Mm-hmm. And apparently, the city attorney said that landowners in eminent domain situations during these negotiations, they get extra benefits once eminent domain is brought to the table.
Such as?
That's a good question. I haven't found those out. But supposedly, there are benefits that such eminent domain, when eminent domain is brought to the table. Wait for a follow-up on that one.
Well, we'll definitely look forward to hearing back from you and following this fascinating story and others out there in the Santee area.
Most definitely. I'll be back.
We're broadcasting at San Diego Performance Academy Studio right here in Santee.
Glad to have you guys here.
Thank you for joining us.
Excellent.
This is a breaking news alert live from the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alert Service.
Two brush fires over the weekend caused traffic jams and scares for local residents. A 25-acre brush fire forced shutdown of Highway 94 between Otay Lakes and the Barrett Junction area, also shutting down the border crossing at Tecate before firefighters brought the fire under control. A brush fire came dangerously close to homes in La Mesa yesterday, forcing shutdown of lanes on State Route 125. The blaze started when a vehicle fire spread into the brush along the shoulder of southbound 125 near Lemon Avenue. Heartland fire crews found a hillside had caught fire and was swiftly spreading toward homes at the top, fueled by windy conditions. Palm trees were exploding into flames and area residents were evacuated, though some stayed behind to water down their roofs and protect their homes from the fire. Evacuations were conducted by La Mesa Police and San Diego Sheriff officials. A second alarm was swiftly issued. 11 fire engines, a brush rig, 2 medic units, and a sheriff's helicopter all battled the blaze. California Highway Patrol shut down southbound 125 from I-8 to Spring Street as crews fought the fire from the freeway and on streets above. Some surface streets were also shut down, causing traffic congestion as fleeing residents joined motorists detoured off of 125. The fire, which started at 2 p.m., was fully contained by approximately 3 p.m. Fire officials credit defensible space around the homes with preventing any residences from being damaged. Heartland fire officials estimate that 5 acres were burned. One firefighter reportedly suffered a heat-related injury and was transported to a local hospital, but is doing fine, according to Heartland Fire. For KNSJ and East County Magazine, this is Miriam Raftery. Howdy! East County Magazine and KNSJ invite you to our Barbecue and Wild West Fest on Saturday, August 10th from 4 to 7 p.m. at the historic Descanso Town Hall in Descanso. Round up your friends and family for this fun-filled event. We'll have a Wild West show featuring the Hole-in-the-Wall Gang and the Gaskell Brothers reenacting scenes from our region's colorful Western past. The Pine Creek Posse Band will provide live music, so grab your partner and bring your dancing shoes, or should we say cowboy boots. Plus, the Descanso Junction will be cooking up a tri-tip barbecue feast. We'll also have prizes and surprises at our Wild West Fest, which is all a benefit to support our wildfire reporting, alerts, and nonprofit community news. Yee-haw! Reservations are going fast, so save your spot now for our August 10th Wild West Fest. Call 619-698-7617 or email editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Today, you can also find more details at www.eastcountymagazine.org. This is Miriam Raftery with KNSJ and East County Magazine bringing you a Crime Beat report. An El Cajon couple is under arrest for the death of their baby that was left overnight in a car. El Cajon police announced the arrest of Israel Soto and Jessica Quezada for the death of their four-month-old baby. The couple's other three children, ages 3, 2, and 1 year old, have been taken into protective custody by Child Protective Services. On July 27th at 1:30 in the afternoon, police responded to a 911 call at 545 North Mollison, reporting that the infant was not breathing. When officers arrived, they began CPR immediately on the infant, and paramedics arrived. Fire personnel transported the baby, who was unresponsive, to a hospital, where the child died shortly thereafter. An investigation determined that the parents had left the baby in the car overnight after returning from shopping on July 26. The infant was not discovered in the vehicle by family members until 1:30 p.m. on July 27 when they called police. Lieutenant Frank LaHaye with El Cajon Police says, as a result of this criminal negligence, both parents were arrested and booked into county jail. Soto, age 30, was charged with willful cruelty to a child with injury and death. Quezada, 23 years old, was charged with willful cruelty to a child with injury, death, and possession of a controlled substance. The County Medical Examiner's Office has not yet determined the exact cause of death of the child. This investigation is ongoing, and anyone with information is encouraged to contact El Cajon Police at 619-579-3311. If you have information on this incident and wish to remain anonymous, you can also call Crime Stoppers at 888-580-8477.
We're on the road in East County, visiting some amazing towns and meeting some incredible people across our region. Welcome to another adventure on East County Magazine's On the Road.
We are on the road in East County at the Mission Trails Regional Park, in many ways the heart and soul of San Diego County. I'm Leon Thompson, and I'm here with our intrepid traveler, host, and East County Magazine editor, Miriam Raftery. The very first thing that struck me, Miriam, is that such a beautiful place, so rich in San Diego history, is so accessible. This is essentially the geographical center of the indigenous people of San Diego, the Kumeyaay. And it's easy to see why, with flowing water, lakes, and abundant vegetation, all protected by tall cliffs and mountains. It's no wonder that this very spot would be the center of Kumeyaay life and so much of San Diego's history.
Mission Trails is the largest urban regional park in America, with close to 6,000 acres. It has a spectacular visitor center and a museum where you can learn about the wildlife of the region and the Native Americans who used to inhabit this area. Let's go in now and listen to some of the interactive displays where you can hear wildlife of the region, such as coyotes, mountain lions, owls, hawks, eagles, and much more. Listen, and see how many wild animals you can hear.
What really brings the park alive is the work of the Mission Trails Regional Park Foundation, and the person most responsible for providing and promoting the educational and recreational opportunities is Jay Wilson, the head of the NTRP Foundation. Here he is talking with Miriam Raftery. Let's listen.
Jay, what's it like working in this spectacular setting?
Not very many people have an office of 5,800 acres, but I'm one of those fortunate people.
So it's a tough job, but somebody's got to do it.
It's tough, exactly.
Tell us a little bit more about the park.
This building here at the Visitor Center actually opened in February of 1995. The foundation, which I'm affiliated with, is a support group. The city owns all of the facilities and all of the grounds.
Now, they have a lot of activities here.
Within the park, we have 40 miles of trails. So you can go hiking, you can mountain bike, ride a regular bicycle, jog, you can rock climb. You can ride a horse if you bring your own horse. There are about 6 miles of horse trails in the park. If you're interested in a guided tour, every Wednesday, Saturday, and Sunday at 9:30, we offer a free guided walking tour.
Bird watching tours?
We have bird watching tours. It's on the website.
Now, do you have lessons in those? I want to learn how to go rock climbing or mountain biking.
We don't. There are several firms, REI and Southern Terrain, which offer rock climbing schools. That's private. It's really cool. Then you come into the Visitor Center, which is a cool zone during the summer.
And it's a spectacular library, by the way. We're sitting here doing this interview in an almost 360-degree view. Library, glass walls. It's a, like I say, rough place, kids, if you got to study somewhere, but this is it.
This is it, yeah. Sometimes I come in here, particularly if it's raining during the winter.
Fireplace.
Watch the rain come up through the gorge. We have campground. We have 46 great campsites for rustic camping, but no campground operating at the moment. We're city. So they closed it actually in 2011. It's been closed almost 2 years.
What would it take to reopen it?
And it's about $136,000. So it was actually in the proposed budget for the fiscal year 2014, but it didn't make it at the last cut. It depends.
So maybe one of these days, though, it'll get reopened.
We hope so, absolutely.
Now, the visitor center itself is quite spectacular. Not only do you have the indoor facilities, you also have spectacular outdoor patios that overlook beautiful scenery, and you have a magnificent amphitheater out there where I understand you sometimes have some free outdoor entertainment. Tell us what's coming up.
The third Sunday every month at 3 o'clock, we have a concert here in the Visitor Center. We have a 93-seat full-blown theater inside the Visitor Center. And then our programmed outdoor concert is with the San Diego Native American Flute Society.
And beyond flute playing, you have some other activities.
We've had some plays that have been put on by San Diego State.
Tell us about some of the things that you do for the young people of the community.
We have, through San Diego Gas Electric, we have been the recipient of several grants. Mm-hmm. And as a result, probably had close to 10,000 children go through here in the last 3 years through the foundation. The city has a program where they run about 7,000 children through here a year, but with San Gas Electric, we actually at some point visited the classroom with one of our education program instructors. We go in with live animals and talk about plants, get them ready to come to Mission Trails, and they come and have a guided tour. We work with the Boy Scouts. We're actually starting a pilot project with Boy Scout group in San Carlos. We're going to work on an astronomy merit badge through our contacts with the San Diego Astronomy Association.
Now, you also have stargazing parties at night, and those are also free, right?
Those are free, and those are held practically down at the campground. You can go on the website, and it'll tell you when they're there, and they start at dusk and run until about 10 o'clock, and it's free.
Now, you also have a gorgeous rock-lined art gallery here where you have different kinds of art shows.
We had 97 different artists submit artwork, and we selected about 25 of them, and we have 10 month-long art shows a year. In between that, we have a photography contest, an amateur photo contest we've run for 21 years. But the art is up for sale, and for any purchase, 25% of that goes to the Mission Trails Regional Park Foundation.
Of course, there's the museum that we've already talked about as we've gone through that has a lot of information on Kumeyaay history, Native Americans, wildlife of the park. There's also a gift shop here.
Gift shop, yes, it's primarily an educational gift shop. We just got in a great collection of handmade pots and pine needle baskets.
Beautiful carved walking sticks.
Beautiful carved walking sticks, yeah. And the pots and the pine needle baskets come from the Pai Pai tribe, which is affiliated with the Kumeyaay, south of the border in the northern Baja.
You also have a number of classes here.
We have two programs for children. One is Linda Holly's Nature Adventures. She'll start back up in September. It includes songs of hers, and she shows live animals and pelts and talks about plants and bugs. And has really interesting topics, primarily for children 3 and up. And then on most Saturdays, we have an art class for children 4 through about 14, conducted by Nora.
We have Explore Mission Trails Day, which is one of your big events every year.
That's our real big event, and that's where probably everything in the park is free. Third Saturday of May.
Now, it's a little-known fact. Organizations can actually rent this entire venue if they're having a special event.
Corporations and nonprofits will use the facility after hours for fundraisers and priority activities. There's a 4,000-foot terrace out here, and then they rent the building itself and the terrace. Of course, this time of year, it's great when you have an evening function.
Speaking of evening functions, we are having the party of the year here as the launch party for KNSJ coming up on August 3rd. Beautiful Saturday night. We're going to have some stargazing. And tell us a few of the things that you've got lined up.
We'll have a couple of trail guides that will be here walking around talking to people. There's certainly a number of people who have never been here before, so we're always interested to talk to them and get them interested to come back to the park. Mm-hmm. We have a couple of Native American flute players that will be here performing, and the San Diego Astronomy Association will have a couple of telescopes up on the terrace. And I've been amazed over the evenings that we've had here. A number of adults have never looked in a big telescope.
KNSJ is going to be bringing in a lot of speakers, a lot of leaders in the community. They're going to be giving away some awards to different people in the community and having some great food and other kinds of music. And it's just going to be a really fun evening and something not to be missed.
Yeah, there'll be lots of food and entertainment, and it should be a great event. We're looking forward to having everybody here.
Fantastic. Well, we are all looking forward to it, Jay. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Glad to be here.
You can find out more about Mission Trails Regional Park at www.mtrp.org, and you can get tickets for KNSJ's launch party at Mission Trails at www.knsj.org. And this concludes another edition of On the Road in East County.
KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso is on the air, people-powered radio. Please come to our official KNSJ launch party, Saturday, August 3rd, from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. at the beautiful Mission Trails Regional Park Visitor Center.
Come mix and mingle with our radio hosts and our celebrity guests in a spectacular natural setting. Enjoy live music, Native American flute players, delicious food and drinks, stargazing, museum tours, and a scavenger hunt. Golden Mike Awards presented to leaders and activists representing voices in our communities that are underrepresented.
RSVP and buy tickets at www.knsj.org.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
Californians are uniting to protect the river that provides drinking water to about 20 million people in the Southland. The second annual Colorado River Day was held yesterday in San Diego and 5 other western cities to highlight the river's continuing challenge of supply versus demand. Megan Behrens with San Diego Coastkeepers says 70 to 90% of the region's water comes from the Colorado River.
So it's incumbent upon us as stewards of our own community and stewards of the Colorado River and the water we use from it to take care of it.
California has more people depending on Colorado River water than any other state, plus more than 500,000 acres of the state's farmland is irrigated by the river. Barron says the Department of Interior and leaders of the 7 western states are meeting to determine the next steps in river conservation.
While San Diego alone can't have an impact, it's the 7 different states, it's the Department of the Interior, all of us working together to improve how we manage that water and do what we can to conserve it.
A recent study concluded the easiest and most effective way to address the imbalance on the Colorado River was to improve urban and agriculture water conservation. For Public News Service, I'm Lori Abbott.
This is Miriam Raftery with KNSJ and East County Magazine bringing you a Crime Beat report. An El Cajon couple is under arrest for the death of their baby that was left overnight in a car. El Cajon police announced the arrest of Israel Soto and Jessica Quezada for the death of their four-month-old baby. The couple's other three children, ages 3, 2, and 1 year old, have been taken into protective custody by Child Protective Services. On July 27th at 1:30 in the afternoon, police responded to a 911 call at 545 North Mollison, reporting that the infant was not breathing. When officers arrived, they began CPR immediately on the infant, and paramedics arrived. Fire personnel transported the baby, who was unresponsive, to a hospital, where the child died shortly thereafter. An investigation determined that the parents had left the baby in the car overnight after returning from shopping on July 26. The infant was not discovered in the vehicle by family members until 1:30 p.m. on July 27th when they called police. Lieutenant Frank LaHaye with El Cajon Police says, as a result of this criminal negligence, both parents were arrested and booked into county jail. Soto, age 30, was charged with willful cruelty to a child with injury and death. Quezada, 23 years old, was charged with willful cruelty to a child with injury, death, and possession of a controlled substance. The county medical examiner's office has not yet determined the exact cause of death of the child. This investigation is ongoing, and anyone with information is encouraged to contact El Cajon Police at 619-579-3311. If you have information on this incident and wish to remain anonymous, you can also call Crime Stoppers at 888-580-8477.
In the good old summertime, in the good old summertime, strolling through the shady lanes with your baby mine. You hold her hand and she holds yours, and that's a very good sign.
This is a public service announcement from the County of San Diego. As temperatures climb, it's important to stay cool. Seniors and those without air conditioning are particularly vulnerable to heat-related illness. The county has provided a list of cool zones where you can beat the heat, including places in East County, such as libraries and senior centers. All are free and open to the public during designated hours. You can find a list of school zones in your area at www.eastcountymagazine.org.
You're listening to East County Magazine, the voice of East County. We reflect your interest, not special interest. As a nonprofit, we rely on community support. You can help us provide community news and reflect a rich diversity of voices by donating or becoming a sustaining member of www.eastcountymagazine.org.
KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, your network for social justice.
Now, straight from the headlines, we bring you the latest top newsmakers.
On Friday, July 26th, the Grossmont Union High School District issued its response to findings of a grand jury report. Back in May, the grand jury report, titled Fool Me Once, Fool Me Twice, concluded that the district's residents deserved more clarity from the school board regarding a proposed 12th high school in Alpine. Voters twice passed bond measures intended to help fund costs of building the new high school, but the district's board majority repeatedly delayed or blocked plans for construction. In May, the grand jury recommended that the board declare unconditionally by December 31st if they are going to build the 12th high school or not, using funds from Propositions H and U. That declaration was to include a credible timeline and construction start date, plus funds placed in an escrow account to assure the work will be done. If the Grossmont District decided not to build the high school, the grand jury said, it should then cooperate with the Alpine Union School District in support of the community's ongoing effort to become a unified school district that could serve high school students as well as elementary and middle school ones. Now, however, the board has issued a lengthy response disputing numerous facts in the grand jury report and insisting the district cannot afford to build the school at this time due to declining enrollment and state budget cuts. The board refused to make any commitment at all to build the new high school, noting, for our response, we will simply quote Benjamin Franklin, nothing is certain except death and taxes. As for the grand jury recommendation to cooperate with the Alpine Union School District in support of its unification effort, should the board decide not to commit to building a high school, the board response offered this conflicting statement. We agree to this recommendation. The GUHSD board reaffirms our commitment to build the 12th high school in Alpine when bond conditions permit, without compromising the quality of the education for students served at other district schools, and upon the restoration of ADA funding for the district to the level it was at the time Proposition U was passed in 2008. Thus, the district continues to claim it wants to build the high school, but without offering any specifics or clarity to voters that the grand jury requested. The district implies that it will not cooperate with unification to empower the Alpine Unified District to build the school as long as the district continues making vague promises with no timetables. The board response was supported by Chairman Jim Kelly, as well as members Robert Shield and Dick Hoy. Members Priscilla Schreiber and Jim Stieringer opposed the board's response, however. The board response is posted on the district website at www.guhsd.net. East County Magazine had interviewed three prominent Alpine community leaders about the grand jury findings before the board issued its response. Some of our guests had predicted that the district would ignore the grand jury recommendations, and they discussed their plan of action should this very thing occur. Here now are our interviews with these vocal critics of the board policy, taped shortly after the grand jury report was released in late May and before the board issued its response today. This is Miriam Raftery. This week, I'm talking with newsmakers from Alpine about a grand jury report that criticizes the Grossmont Union High School District. For years, Alpine residents have contended that the district misused bond monies from Prop H and Prop U. The voters twice approved these bond measures, which included funds to build a high school in Alpine. But the district spent bond monies instead on other projects, including some that were not even listed in the bonds, such as an Olympic-sized swimming pool at one campus and a performing arts center at another. The grand jury, in its report titled Fool Us Once, Fool Us Twice, agreed that Alpine voters deserve more clarity and issued recommendations for the district to take to resolve the conflict by the end of this year. My first guest, Sal Casamassima, chairs the Alpine High School Citizens Committee. Now, Sal, how many years have Alpine citizens been trying to get a high school built?
We've been working at it for about 20 years, and very intensively for the last decade.
Why is having a high school in Alpine so important to residents up there?
Well, right now, our students, once they graduate from middle school, have to travel, as we say, down the hill from Alpine and go about 15 to 20 miles in one direction to get to either Steel Canyon or Granite Hills High School. And it's a dangerous drive.
Right. Now, you're a parent of a middle school student, and you've certainly seen over the years exactly what those dangers can result in.
Yeah, there have been a number of actual fatalities or serious injuries involving students traveling to or from those schools down the hill. And that's something that is one of the major reasons we want the school, other than the fact that we deserve a high school in Alpine for a community of our size.
What's wrong with the way the Grossmont District has handled this whole situation, in your view?
I can best describe it as bait and switch, where they have come to us back in, for example, 2001, 2002, having a bond measure that they failed, and came to us and said, look, Alpine, you need to stop your unification effort and join with us. We'll build a high school for you if you join us and support a new bond measure, which ultimately became Prop H, to build a high school in Alpine. And that would include other improvements to the school district, as well as the construction of the high school. We also passed Prop U, a subsequent bond, and in neither case, even though the high school was specifically mentioned in both bond measures, in either case, did they go forward with the construction of the high school. They have repeatedly broken their promise to us.
So the Grossmont District actually went to the Alpine Union School District and told them to back off of unification efforts if you would all help back their bond measures for the high school. Unification, for those who may not know, means that the Alpine District would expand beyond elementary and middle school to actually include a high school. Now, I understand that more recently, some of the parents up there have decided it's just time for a divorce from the Grossmont District and that there's a new effort at unification. Tell us about your petition.
Right. You know, when we decided at this point in time that the Grossmont District has firmly decided they're not going to build this high school. And so we have decided to pursue unification, and therefore that means we would be divorcing ourselves from Grossmont and seeking the funds from Grossmont through the State Board of Education to build our own high school.
Right.
That process is going forward.
The grand jury has recommended that the district by year's end should announce whether it's actually going to build this high school or not, and that if it is, it needs to put the money into escrow and come up with a realistic timetable for construction. If it decides it's not going to build it, then the grand jury wants to see the district cooperate with Alpine and support the unification effort. So what's next for the people of Alpine in your view?
We have absolutely no faith that the Grossmont School District will follow up on either of the grand jury recommendations, and therefore we're continuing to pursue our unification effort. We're gathering signatures to file our petition with the County Board of Education and State Board of Education, and we will continue to do so.
And you're nearly there, I understand. You have approximately the number of signatures needed
now. We have over 3,000 signatures that we've gathered, and we're in the process of certifying and getting them validated for filing with the County Board of Education.
Thank you very much, Sal. Now, it should be noted that the grand jury, while critical of the district's actions, did not find any criminal wrongdoing. We asked the Grossmont Union High School District to send a representative to the show, and they did not respond. However, district spokesperson Catherine Martin did provide a statement in response to the grand jury report. It read, "We thank the grand jury for its recommendations and interest in serving the needs of all communities located within the Grossmont Union High School District. The district will give serious consideration to these recommendations and will develop a timely response following a thorough review."
My next guests are both Alpine residents who have been actively involved in the Alpine High School issue for some time now.
Chris Laurie is a co-founder of the Alpine K-12 Solutions, which is working to align the various forces here to come up with solutions to this issue. He's also an expert in Prop H and Prop U bond finances. In addition, we have Doug Dean, who is the former chair of the Grossmont Union High School District's 2011 Boundary Committee, and he's also the former chair of the East County Chamber of Commerce Education Committee. In addition, Doug was among the witnesses who were summoned to speak before the grand jury. Now, one of the key arguments that the board has repeatedly raised is that it cannot afford to build a new high school for Alpine due to the state budget cuts and other things. You have indicated, both of you, that you believe the district actually has the money. Doug, let's start with you. Can you please explain?
Yes, I'd be happy to, Maryam. We did a student recovery report that was an appendix to the official boundary report. And what we found in the student recovery report was that the district would gain from 260 to 480 brand new students to the district if the Alpine High School were to be built. Now, ADA is an acronym for average daily attendance, and the current ADA is around $6,000 per student. That's the amount of money that the district receives for each of its students. If you multiply 260 by 6,000, that's about 1.56 million. And that was the lowest range of the estimate. The high range was 480 students, which equates to $2.88 million, which means that building the Alpine High School would have actually made the district money.
Wow, that's amazing. Chris, is that your finding also, having attended so many of these meetings through the years for the Bond Oversight, Citizens Bond Oversight Committee and the board itself and various other meetings?
Yes. Initially, I'll say that I was agreeing with the district's assessment of the declining enrollment and the budget crisis having an impact on their ability to deliver a school to us. But having been party to as many meetings as I have, and seeing the priorities moved to non-essential projects that are going to cost the district additional operating funds, it is evident to me now that really what HS-12 and the lack of building it has become is a political pawn in a struggle.
Did the Citizens Bond Oversight Committee have access to this information that Doug just explained about the fact that the new high school would actually increase enrollment and bring a lot more ADA money into the district?
The committee had one of the members, the chairperson of CBOC. When I first appeared at CBOC and I presented one of the committee members with the question of what about the revenue recovery in the discussion of the school, the gentleman looked at me blankly and said, "What are you referring to?" When I went into a discussion over the recapturing of the revenue from students coming back in from Steele Canyon High School, it was a complete shock, and I confirmed with other members of CBOC that there was no transmission of the information coming back from their chairperson who was on Doug's committee as to any kind of a revenue impact. Their position was strictly based on deferred maintenance and costs associated with the school.
Interesting. Doug, what were some of the other things you observed that you found troubling?
One of the most troubling things about the committee work that we did in regard to the district was the fact that the district was comprised of over 50% minority and ethnic students, which was completely unreflected in the board makeup. I've learned since that the California Voting Rights Act, the CVRA, was passed to address that, and the district seems to be completely out of compliance with the CVRA. And that's very troubling. The CVRA would be of no cost at all to the district. And the only reason I can see for the district to be reluctant in passing it is simply that it would cause the trustees, a couple of the trustees, to possibly lose their seats or to make the races more competitive.
Now, East County Magazine asked the district for public records, and we learned that Superintendent Ralph Swenson admitted in an email that the district actually had commissioned a law firm to write a report advising on whether or not the district was violating the California Voting Rights Act. However, the superintendent told the attorney that he destroyed the report from a law firm, unread, he said, the day that it arrived, claiming that it was no longer needed. To both of you, what do you believe should happen next?
The Alpine unification effort will probably be the sole recourse that our community is going to have in order to extricate ourselves from the scenario. There seems to be very little effort at the administration level to take us off the back of the project list, which is where we were just put back in November. Without being moved up that project list, there will not be funds at the back end of the bond program to build that high school.
So even though they acquired property, some of it through eminent domain, we're still in this quandary here. If the state and the county approve the unification effort, which is required by law, what would happen to all of the bond money that the Grossmont District raised that voters approved through Prop H and Prop U?
That really will come down to the settlement that is going to be prescribed by the county. The intent, I believe, would be to sever our bond obligations unless we were to get cash for that debt.
So potentially the unification effort agreement could require that the district return some or all of that bond money to the Alpine District so that the school could be built.
Yes. Again, the unification is not a cut and dry type of model. Every unification has its unique quirks to it. We have many quirks in ours, and there is plenty of latitude within the law for the county to do its best in giving each party its representative share.
Doug, what do you think should happen next?
Well, thanks for asking, Miriam. I believe that in light of the mismanagement by the trustees of the Props U and H bond funds, and in light of the reluctance of the trustees to enact or comply with the California Voting Rights Act, I believe strongly that the voters need to make their opinion known in 2014. There are a couple of trustees on the current board who I think have done phenomenal work. Priscilla Schreiber has been a strong advocate for Alpine, and Dick Hoy has also been an advocate for Alpine and an advocate for students. I believe that other trustees on the board have their own personal and political agendas, and I believe that the voters should look at those and decide whether they are truly acting in our students' best interests.
Doug, Chris, thank you for sharing this important information with our listeners on East County Magazine's show here on KNSJ 89.1 FM.
Thanks, Miriam.
Thank you, Miriam.
Lynn Manyfire is bringing you the Tribal Beat, covering the news for and about our region's Native American communities. Today's guest on Tribal Beat is Richard Carrico. Richard is a longtime resident of San Diego, and he's lectured for the last 25 years at the Department of American Indian Studies at San Diego State. And he's an adjunct professor at City College, where he teaches anthropology. He has a master's in history and a bachelor's in history and anthropology. His primary research includes the Kumeyaay tribes of San Diego County and Baja, Mexico. He has served as Native American coordinator and principal investigator for survey and evaluation of more than 30,000 acres of Indian trust lands, as well as serving as project director for cultural resources of five Indian tribes. Along with writing more than 30 publications and professional journals, Richard is the author of numerous books, including Strangers in a Stolen Land, The Indians of San Diego County, From Prehistory to the New Deal, and he's currently working on a new book. Richard, I'm honored to have you join me today. Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule.
Well, hello, Lynn. I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
I'd like to talk a bit about both your books, the new one as well as the most recent one, Strangers in a Stolen Land. Can you share a little bit about both books and your inspiration for writing them?
Sure. I wrote Strangers in a Stolen Land. It started actually back in the 1980s and into the 1990s because there was no one book that a student or a layperson, and I made it very much toward a layperson, could pick up and understand that Native American people had been here for 12,000 years at least, and that at one time there were 80 villages throughout San Diego County and 20,000 Native Americans living here, and then how all that changed when the Europeans came in, first the Spaniards, Mexicans, and later Americans. And I also wanted a book that had a more of an Indian voice in it. I've spent a lot of time interviewing elders and doing archaeology, and I wanted to combine that dirt side of it, that's from-the-ground archaeology, with the voice of some of the elders, Leroy Elliott and Jane Dumas, and some of those people here from the back country, frankly. So that was the impetus, and I had written several articles, and people would come to me and say, well, you've kind of teased us with a little candy here. We want the main course now. What's the rest of this? And so that's the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey used to say. And so the book goes from 12,000 years ago, which is the earliest dates we have for San Diego County, approximately, up to 1938. And I intentionally stopped in 1938 after the New Deal and after the removal of the Capitan Grande Indians to Viejas and Barona, because that's my strength, that's my time period. And then after that, that's another book that might happen in the future.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
From your perspective, what changes have you seen in San Diego's tribal communities in the last 30 years?
I've seen enormous changes. When I used to lecture 30 years ago, if you were in my class 30 years ago, I would say that poverty on the average reservation in San Diego was 48 to 50% below the poverty line, that unemployment was 38 to 40%, that fetal alcohol syndrome was a major problem, and that women's groups and the Marine Corps and Salvation Army were taking turkeys and dinners up to the Indians on the reservations and that whole outreach program. And what's happened with gaming, because of gaming, but not entirely, but because of finances, because of money, is I've seen the tribes now pull themselves up. Most of them have done a very good job. They've had very good leaders like Anthony Pico and Danny Tucker and folks who are very strong, almost traditional leaders, and they've pulled themselves up. And while using the federal government based on some things we can talk about and the county, but basically on their own. And what I've seen is now they're revitalizing their languages. And so while the Kumeyaay language was taking a serious dip by 20 years ago and very few people were speaking it except for some elders, now it's being taught at Cuyamaca College. It's being taught at Verona.
Really?
Yes. Yeah. Stan Rodriguez and Raul Chrisman from Viejas have put together classes now. And you can actually take a class in Kumeyaay, and it goes on and on and on, beginning, middle, and advanced. I've seen the ability to bring people up from Pai Pai territory and Tipai territory in Baja California, native people, and they work with the tribes up here and talk about language and basket making and pottery. So it's truly been a revitalization, and watching that younger generation realize that what their grandmother told them was important, and knowing a Kumeyaay word for tree or for acorn is part of your culture, because language is culture, and watching little six-year-old kids speak an entire sentence in Kumeyaay. That wouldn't have happened nearly as often 20, 30 years ago. And then just the sense of pride, of tribalness, of being a nation of people, not just a band of people.
As you just mentioned, and we had spoken about it earlier, you're passionate about the revitalization of the Kumeyaay language and culture. You've just mentioned a few things of how you see that's happening. What else? How else do you see that happening in the community?
I see it happening in most of the major reservations now have also formed a group called the Circle of Elders, or somehow to honor the elder. And so they have lunches for them. They take them on field trips. And again, there's that whole reaching out to both sides, the very young and the very old, not one or the other. I see it in the youth are playing a role because they're coming to a project I've been working on. They come to the elder and say, okay, you're being tape recorded and we're hearing you talk about place names, like Tecate is actually a Kumeyaay word.
Really?
Tijuana is an Indian word. It's not Spanish. Tijuana means swept clean from the beach, swept clean.
Oh.
Tecate means to, it's a knife, essentially. So you're telling, granddad's recording this with you and you're hearing these, but what we want is we want to see an internet. We want to see it on video. We want to see something alive because they're a generation that wants movement. And frankly, like most younger children, have a shorter attention span.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm seeing that whole movement of the very young and the older people blending together to form something that in 5 or 6 years will be huge. There's fiestas now held about native foods. Going back and using native foods, there's actually a couple cookbooks out.
Great.
One out of Heyday Press out of San Francisco or out of Berkeley, and there's recipes from San Diego County in there of using native products. Yeah.
That is awesome.
So again, it's in the kitchen, it's on the internet, it's back revitalization of language. There's a Kumeyaay mapping site that you can go to on the internet, and right now it just gives you the name of what does Poway mean? It's not Poway. Poway. What does Poway mean? Well, it means convergence or a point where two things meet, and you click on it and you find that out. And what we're doing now is interviewing and recording elders saying these Kumeyaay words
mm-hmm.
so that when you click on Tecate or you click on Poway, you'll hear a native speaker say it then, and then a picture will come up. It's out there. People think all this culture got completely lost, and unfortunately anthropologists kind of fed into that by saying 50 years ago, I'm interviewing the last of the last of the. So anthropologists almost killed them off, in press at least. But meanwhile, the elders are sitting back there going, no, he wasn't the last one. And we just didn't tell you that story because we didn't want to share it with you. Because in the Spanish period, we would be killed.
That's very
telling
common
that story.
With a lot of tribes, actually.
It is.
Yeah.
So it went underground. So I almost see it like an underground river that's now coming back up, and there's springs all over the place, and they're bubbling out, and people are drinking from those springs, and they're getting knowledge. And so to me, as a historian and an anthropologist, it's been a phenomenal process watching that. But as a person versus the academic side, it's been even more phenomenal to go on a reservation and hear people talking Kumeyaay over lunch. That would not have happened much 30 years ago.
For you, that must be a rewarding experience, huh?
It is, and it just feeds into my passion, of course. It's like, and I'm so happy to have been a part of it, not to have been instrumental in any way, because I'm not, but to just have been a part of, like, a leaf floating along on this amazing river that's going great places. It's just so cool.
And building stronger.
Yep.
Finally, with all the work you've done in our native communities with regards to sacred sites, what's your personal opinion of the wind energy projects on the various reservations?
I put wind energy into all the categories of, let's say, a large casino, a wind energy project, fracking up in the northern tier, you know, whatever thing's going on is going to change the land. I always put it in the context of, first of all, I have to look at it from, is it serving the Native American community? So if it's on a reservation, I have to assume that the tribal council and maybe the general council voted on this.
Mm-hmm.
And so are they going to get economic revenue out of it? In some cases, are they going to get power that they wouldn't have had on the reservation before? Because there
mm-hmm.
are still some reservations
mm-hmm.
throughout the state that don't have electricity. And then you have to balance that off. That's the pragmatic side, is does it serve a practical purpose with, is it actually endangering sacred sites? And then that's when it gets touchy, because they would have been required under federal law, all tribes are required on trust land to do environmental studies.
Right.
People think they don't have to do any environmental studies because it's exempt from the county. That's not true.
They just have
to take it to the federal level. So assuming that they did their work and assuming that they hired good anthropologists and archaeologists, I would like to believe that those wind turbines did not get sited on a known sacred site. Having said that, for many Kumeyaay, as many Native Americans throughout America, the land itself is sacred. The viewshed is sacred. And so if you drive past Campo today or La Posta, Manzanita area, and you see those giant turbines, and now they're building some south of the border as well, a lot of them, I've certainly talked to elders who have said, yes, they did not put them on top of a sacred site, but they've impacted the sacred landscape. That as a child growing up, I could walk out of my house and see the hills and think about my grandfather's stories. When I walk out now, I see wind turbines. I hear wind turbines. I see dead birds on the ground. And so for some people, it's the wrong thing to do. But I guess I always try to come back to Native Americans are no different at some level than any other human. There's always going to be a disparity of thought between the pragmatic side, the energy side. There's always going to be, should we build a shopping center near Gettysburg or not? Does that defame Gettysburg? Do we do wind turbines on Indian land? Do we put a road across a reservation? So at what point are you bringing the tribe along versus at what point are you hurting them for generations to come by an action you want to do now?
That's a common issue, the traditionals versus the progressives on all the reservations across the country. This is definitely a complicated issue in a lot of areas. As a matter of fact, I'd like to invite you to come back next week and speak more about maybe some political views as far as you had mentioned something about, you know, how Reagan, how Bill Clinton, how Obama is affecting the tribes even locally here. Would you be willing to join us again?
I'd be glad to do that because that's a whole other issue, but it has roots that go back hundreds of years with the federal government. Absolutely. I'd be glad to, Lynn.
That's awesome. Thank you so much. That's all the time we have for today. I want to thank my guest, Richard Carrico, for sharing his rich knowledge of the tribes here in San Diego. And I'd like to invite him back to maybe talk to us again next month if in his busy schedule. And I know he is busy. Thank you, listeners, for tuning in to the Tribal Beat. If you have a story you would like to hear more about or a person of interest in the community, please contact me at tribalbeat@eastcountymagazine.org. That's tribalbeat@eastcountymagazine.org.
Howdy! East County Magazine and KNSJ invite you to our Barbecue and Wild West Fest on Saturday, August 10th from 4 to 7 p.m. at the historic Descanso Town Hall in Descanso. Round up your friends and family for this fun-filled event. We'll have a Wild West show featuring the Hole-in-the-Wall Gang and the Gaskell Brothers reenacting scenes from our region's colorful Western past.
The Pine Creek Posse Band will provide live music, so grab your partner and bring your dancing shoes, or should we say cowboy boots. Plus, the Descanso Junction will be cooking up a tri-tip barbecue feast. We'll also have prizes and surprises at our Wild West Fest, which is all a benefit to support our wildfire reporting, alerts, and nonprofit community news. Yeehaw! Reservations are going fast, so save your spot now for our August 10th Wild West Fest. Call 619-698-7617 or email editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Today, you can also find more details at www.eastcountymagazine.org.
This is Miriam Raftery with KNSJ and East County Magazine bringing you a Crime Beat report. An El Cajon couple is under arrest for the death of their baby that was left overnight in a car. El Cajon police announced the arrest of Israel Soto and Jessica Quezada for the death of their four-month-old baby. The couple's other three children, ages 3, 2, and 1 year old, have been taken into protective custody by Child Protective Services. On July 27th at 1:30 in the afternoon, police responded to a 911 call at 545 North Mollison, reporting that the infant was not breathing. When officers arrived, they began CPR immediately on the infant, and paramedics arrived. Fire personnel transported the baby, who was unresponsive, to a hospital, where the child died shortly thereafter. An investigation determined that the parents had left the baby in the car overnight after returning from shopping on July 26. The infant was not discovered in the vehicle by family members until 1:30 p.m. on July 27th when they called police. Lieutenant Frank LaHaye with El Cajon Police says, as a result of this criminal negligence, both parents were arrested and booked into county jail. Soto, age 30, was charged with willful cruelty to a child with injury and death. Quezada, 23 years old, was charged with willful cruelty to a child with injury, death, and possession of a controlled substance. The County Medical Examiner's Office has not yet determined the exact cause of death of the child. This investigation is ongoing, and anyone with information is encouraged to contact El Cajon Police at 619-579-3311. If you have information on this incident and wish to remain anonymous, you can also call Crime Stoppers at 888-580-8477. This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's live radio show. We extend our appreciation to the San Diego Performance Academy for the use of their studio, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, Brian Boyko, royalty-free music,
Frank Nora, Kevin MacLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.